Malcolm Holmline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning broadcast. Mr. Holmline, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to be with you.
Today is a, there's no question that current events are very important, but you yourself always remind us about remembering and remembering the lessons of years ago. And I must share with you, and I'm sure you'll appreciate this, especially today on the 27th of January, I must share with you something that Ruth Lichtenstein, who is the editor of Hamodia, one of the great scholars of our community, in my opinion, she sent the following along via email. Today, the world will mark the 67th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, which took place on January the 27th, 1945, the 13th day in the month of Shvat. It's a time of reflection, of remembrance, and of renewed commitment to Holocaust education and awareness. It is also a time to recall that in Auschwitz, the rich and the poor, the famous and the unknown, the religious and the assimilated, faced the same fate. Together, they were marched into the gas chambers or died of starvation, of exhaustion, of beatings, and shootings. Moshe Shmuel, an Auschwitz survivor and beloved and greatly respected member of the Jewish community of Salonika, later served as Rav and Shliach Tzibor in the Feldofing DP camp. This is how he described it. I am number 114577. I learned many things in Auschwitz, but one thing I will never forget. Kol Yisrael Chaverim. Everyone was pushed together to crematorium. From Salonika and Rhodes, from France and Scandinavia, from Germany and Romania, Russians, Poles, and Czechs, elderly and babies, all of them children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Today is the day, Mr. Holmline, the 27th of January, that the United Nations and the world calls Holocaust Remembrance Day. Good to look back for a moment before we pursue the events of today.
Absolutely. First of all, Mrs. Lichtenstein is really a very special and unique person. Whose publication, but more than that, her work on the Holocaust is really a seminal one, and I hope that everybody will sit down with their children, because if you look at the studies, it shows that young people, even those in the Jewish community, do not know the facts. They do not know what happened. They need to be told, not because we dwell on it, but because we learned the lessons from it, and that the reason why we look back is in order to look forward. And with all the challenges we have today, it is not the 1930s, but it could be. And we have to take the steps to prevent it, and you can only do that if you understand the lessons of the past.
What happens in the UN today, by the way? There is an official ceremony, correct?
Actually, there have been a series of ceremonies. I spoke at one attended by many members of the Russian Jewish community, Ukrainian Jewish community. The Ukrainian ambassador chaired it, and the Israeli ambassador spoke, and I had the privilege of being one of the speakers there. And today there will be the official commemoration in which the president of the General Assembly will speaking. He is the former Qatari ambassador, and I met with him yesterday, and he indicated that he was speaking, and he changed his plans in order to be there as a statement by him. This has become, I know a lot of people were skeptical about it and whether the UN would actually continue it,
right?
But around the world, and we've seen in Europe that countries are taking it seriously. And when Germany's polls show that 20% harbor anti-Semitic feelings, and when you see the rise of neo-Nazi groups there, even if small but very visible, and the other incidents around Europe and here, it becomes all the more important.
There was an arrest this week, 19-year-old in the Bergen County firebombings. Any affiliation between this young man and any official terror group? And secondly, what do we learn from the fact that such a young man in New Jersey would go ahead and pursue this type of activity?
And it says that he did it because he hates Jews.
Right.
It's quite clear what the message should be, because not only this incident, but the spate of incidents that we've had, and our secure community network and people who want to look at what they can do in their communities to increase protection should go to the scnus.org website. That stands for Secure Community Network, us.org network, to see their website to get information on what we should do. We have to take preventative measures. We have to educate the kids to what to look for and to be alert. And the fact that a guy grows up and today finds the expression – for his feelings in hatred of Jews should be a warning.
And official...
We shouldn't exaggerate these things either. We shouldn't jump on every case. As we know, the one on Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn turned out to be an insurance scam. We have to be judicious in how we react to it, but that, because otherwise we undermine our credibility.
Yeah. I mean, in that one, because of the strategy that the scammers used, it was more understandable why there might be a reaction the way there was. But,
oh, absolutely.
And no ties to official terror groups from this 19-year-old, right?
No, not that we know of yet. It's the investigation. They took a lot of material from his home. We do not yet know what was in that material.
Malcolm, Ahmadinejad wants to talk. And frankly, the President of the United States gave an indication this week that talks should continue. How seriously do you take the President of Iran when he makes a statement like that?
It's a sham. It buys him time. He has no intention of having any kind of serious discussion. They still talk about attacking the United States, Israel. They talk about the preemptive move now to cut off Europe because of Europe's plan that was adopted to cut off the new agreements on oil now, to embargo their oil, and by July to cut off all the existing agreements because they wanted to supposedly give countries a chance to adjust. The president supposedly sent letters through the UN and through the Iraqi president and through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who represents U.S. interests. The U.S. has indicated there was not a letter. The Iranians are quoting the letter, but most of all saying, while the first part talked about the red lines, about closing the Straits of Hormuz, the second part was this kind of outreach. It might have been done verbally. I don't know yet. But what we do know is that it's important to think about how the Iranians perceive any kind of message of this kind. And while the option for them to give up their program always existed, nobody realistic thinks that they will choose that option or have taken any steps in that direction.
Who needs letters, though? I mean, the President of the United States said it clearly in the State of the Union address. America's determined to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and I will take no options off the table to achieve that goal, but a peaceful resolution of this issue is still possible and far better, and if Iran changes course and meets its obligations, it can rejoin the community of nations.
We see it in regard to two cases right now, the actions versus Syria, the actions versus Iran. Here you have a consensus of the international community regarding Iran. After 20 years, they finally woke up to this reality of what Iran represents. And yet, we see in terms of the implementation now in Europe just beginning and having an impact in Iran, because otherwise they wouldn't be reacting the way they are. We know that the rial, their currency, has fallen very aggressively. We know that the pressure, the international pressure, which had they put it on a year ago, maybe we would not be facing the problem that we face now. But the fact is that you have people, countries that are helping them to bypass the sanctions still.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with Syria. The Security Council is supposed to meet today to talk about sanctions on Syria. And it's linked, obviously, because of the connection between Syria and Iran. Iran helping them, Hezbollah helping them. We know that Hezbollah guards surrounded Assad, not his own army, at the rally 2 weeks ago, that 200 cars and buses came from Hezbollah territory to the rally that Assad held, and the Arab League is bringing them the movement wanting a resolution and a more stringent resolution, because their mission obviously failed, even though they've continued it for a month. But the language now is going to be written in such a way as to protect the Russians' interests. They're going to, you know, write in there things that will protect the economic and military interests of Russia so that Russia will go along with it, which means that you're going to end up with such a watered-down resolution. Again, that the message to them all is that if you hold out, yeah. Russia right now has supposedly got $5 billion in weapons in the pipeline to Syria, including MiG-29s and a new deal of 30 Yaks and submarines even. What does Syria need submarines now? They're fighting an internal battle that's getting closer and closer to Damascus. Unfortunately, the opposition is very divided, and they're shooting each other and fighting amongst each other and doing things that are reminiscent in some places of what the regime did. But the fact is that we're sending these mixed messages about what the intent is, and what Russia calls for, you know, reconvening the P5+1. President Obama, you know, holds out again the hand to Ahmadinejad. It may be a message to the Iranian people. It may be trying to, but the Iranian people want to see the West being tough. They're living with the consequences of these sanctions and paying the price every day with unemployment, with food going up. They've canceled subsidies worth billions and billions of dollars because they can't afford it. Iran even had to cut back money to Hamas and Hezbollah on this. And yet we find out they're exporting to our ally, Iraq, more than $5 billion worth of goods each year, not including oil exports. So what do you think they see this? And they say that, you know, we can bypass everything. Turkey helps them bypass. Others do. In the meantime, you know that five trucks were caught going from Syria, from Iran to Syria, carrying the components for chemical weapons and missiles that will carry them.
So the way business works, Iraq could end up being a proxy state of Iran.
And that's exactly what they said. If you read some of the statements this week, that is precisely the message. They said, we're prepared to replace Syria with Iraq in the chain that brings them to Hezbollah. They're trying to reinforce Hezbollah. Hezbollah has its own problems right now, and the whole question of the relationship. Hamas is a different story, pulling out of Syria, and they have a much more tense relationship, which you can talk about, and have their own internal issues. But we saw Soleimani, the head of the Al-Quds part of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, who's been muted all along to be the successor to Ahmadinejad, saying that South Lebanon and Iraq are the Islamic Republic's alternative for Syria.
We made quite an investment in Iraq, let me tell you.
Well, they have all along, and you know, we've talked about it many times, but people don't want to hear it.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honline is with us. Is there an official oil embargo or not? I mean, you mentioned EU sanctions and the you know, the desire to step them up. This week we read about it. Oil embargo. Is this an official embargo? Is this one that really can hurt Iran? Is this more empty words? What is it?
No, this is a real embargo. The problem is, as I said, it's two phases. One is that in February they're supposed to stop all new contracts, but the existing contracts are allowed to go till July, supposedly to allow people to adjust.
So what if they decide not to embargo this summer?
Well, no, they go into effect, but many of them have already cut back. We know that there's a cutback in exports. Now the Iranians are threatening to move preemptively and that they're going to cut it off, which means that they lose the income. We know that the Saudis and others have stepped up production. There is plenty of oil, so people's concern that the price is going to go to $200 is not justified, except that it's manipulated. But what we see now? The step up of violence in Qatif, which is the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, where Iran has long instigated the Shiite population, which is very large there, but that's where Saudi Arabia's oil is. It's 14 miles across the waterway from Bahrain, where we had some renewed fighting this week, too. So Iran is going to use every opportunity. They've threatened the Gulf states that if they step up production to make up for Iran, they're going to suffer consequences. And the West should have come out right then and there and said, you touch anybody, there's going to be massive consequences.
Well, that's not going to happen right now. The West needs some leadership who's willing to do that. Did you read the Bronner article in the Times about Israel and sensing Iran's bluffing when it comes to the possibility of hitting them militarily?
Whose article?
Ethan Bronner.
No.
It was it's such a strange thing. It says here, Israeli intelligence estimates backed by academic studies have cast doubt on the widespread assumption that a military strike on Iranian nuclear facilities would set off a catastrophic set of events, one of them, of course, being sky-high oil prices and terrorism, etc., and a whole regional battle. It seems like such a strange analysis. Like now academia can figure out how Iran will react if Israel decides to militarily take out their nuclear facility?
Well, this speculation has been used all along to try to undermine Israel's case. And even Dempsey, who had a very good visit, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was in Israel last weekend, had a very good visit and said some remarkable things about the U.S. Israel continuing the military cooperation, enhancing the military cooperation, but said we view Iran differently. And in subsequent discussions, I know cited some of the questions about the timetable, and Defense Minister Barak spoke yesterday, and he outlined that three conditions or three categories of questions that have to be answered in terms of Israel acting. One, does it have the ability to carry, to cause severe damage to Iran's nuclear sites and bring about a real delay in the project? And can the military and the Israeli people withstand the possible counterattack? Second, does Israel have tacit support from America, from the international community to do it, meaning Saudi Arabia, other countries? And third, have all the other possibilities to stop Iran been exhausted? And this was in the Times, if you saw the report. So I think that this is the highlighting of these things is meant to say, well, we don't really have to deal with Iran immediately, that the timetable, it always loosens the pressure. And the answer is that we can't go to containment.
It's funny. I thought that it's just the opposite, that it would accelerate the desire to get into Iran militarily, because this study shows that the consequences are not nearly going to be as bad as one would think.
There are both parts to that about the consequences, about the likelihood of retaliation. But I think that part of the campaign that we've seen in the media is to lessen the urgency of action. You know that in the Arab world, you look at where Iran's standing, how it's plummeted, both for their support of Syria, for other things, but their nuclear program has not gained them support. They were riding high before, and they are way down. They're negative in every country except Lebanon. But there was an interesting article about not being able to have a Japan-like solution where they are able to retain their nuclear technology and not believe that they're going to produce a weapon. It's just not going to be the case. This is not Japan. This is a regime that keeps swearing to destroy Israel, destroy others, is always working on that. We saw the planned attack in Azerbaijan that Iranian military intelligence was supposedly involved in, where they were going to kill the rabbi and a teacher from a Chabad school and the Israeli ambassador, and they were going to be paid $150,000 for this. So, you know, they mean it. They carry it out.
Yeah, listen to the enemy.
They do, and they get the message very clearly.
Their believability is way up there. Malcolm, don't you find it fascinating, as you observe what's going on in the GOP now, with all these debates, etc., in general, the whole situation, all the different things that we focus on each and every week, don't you find it fascinating that the President of the United States, and by the way, this is not a condemnation of the President, this is simply an observation of the times we're living in. If you look at the percentage of time spent on foreign policy in the State of the Union address, I don't think it was 10% of his speech. And don't you find that fascinating? You would think, especially in this era, based on the way State of the Unions have gone in the past, that obviously at least half of it would be spent on foreign policy. But because of the situation in the United States, people are so focused on this financial crisis and all the things related to it that he spent very little time on any of this. In fact, his statement on Iran was one of just a few paragraphs. If not for the Somali pirates, it would have been even less, by the way, about things happening outside the United States.
And getting Osama bin Laden.
And bin Laden as well, right.
But first of all, your observation is right. But it's been a trend that we've seen over the last couple of years in the State of the Union messages that the president devotes little time to the foreign policy agenda. And it is true what you said, and that is you see it in the debates amongst the Republican candidates as well, that they do not spend a great deal of time focused on the international agenda. They make the performance statements, or they will attack the administration or attack past records, or defend past records on it. But the fact is that the throwaway line on Israel, and the president said, you know, the security guarantee is ironclad, their commitment.
And all people are.
But if you look at the rest of it, there is very little attention. And what many people in the international community are looking for is a plan to see, does the United States have a real approach? Do we really understand what's happening in the Arab Middle East? Do we know what these developments are going to lead to? What steps are we taking to anticipate, let's say, Assad's fall? What are we doing to see to it that the chemical weapons piles are there are going to be contained? Do we have a plan to counter what the Russians are doing at the UN. I mean, so far, all the diplomatic approaches have failed to affect Assad. He still continues the killing the people and the actions. Now France and Britain are taking the lead. The Arab League is supposedly pushing for some sort of resolution because they have no option. They're not willing to put troops on the ground and short of those options. So why should the Syrians care?
So true. Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohammed Badi said that his movement has not violated the peace treaty with Israel, while the Jewish state has. Badi made the remarks following former U.S. President Jimmy Carter's visit to Egypt. Badi said that he asked Carter whether he still thought the accords were just. He answered that the Palestinians were largely deprived due to the treaty, Badi said. Was this the most outrageous thing that Carter said during his visit to Egypt, or was there more?
Well, during his trip to Egypt, that was not. Badi, first of all, is an extremist who has made terrible comments, talked about cutting off Israel, etc. The Muslim Brotherhood right now is taking a much more moderate public stance.
Right.
They are, you know, looking at the responsibility of leadership and saying we have to focus on the economy, saying they're going to impose Sharia law. We should not be fooled by this. This is, you know, the modus operandi. They are going to be much more pulled by the 25% additional that the Salafis have in addition to their 47%. We saw it in the election of the speaker from the Muslim Brotherhood, speaker of the assembly, and now they will move towards the writing the constitution, where they will not do things blatantly. They will implement gradually. Now, Badi's comments, the more important part is what that Jimmy Carter, who for some reason has credibility still among some people in the United States, should see that he's undermining his own legacy.
Mm-hmm.
This is his whole claim to fame.
That's right.
What he got is Nobel Prize. Let him give it back.
That's right. If, in fact, not all parties are benefiting from this treaty that he brokered, then he has to call it a failure, right?
He is a failure. We know that.
Right.
That was not the surprising part. But, you know, he says a lot of things that make no sense, and thank God a lot of it doesn't get coverage. But the situation in Egypt, today marks the one-year anniversary of what happened there.
Meaning the protests and riots?
And the overthrow of
Mubarak.
And I think it took only 18 days from this whole process. So right now we believe that the Muslim Brotherhood and the generals may be working to try and create a common outline, not to have a fight, a showdown. But it's inevitable that you're going to come to that point where they will. The Muslim Brotherhood is going to have to try to deliver, and even the reaction to this, the backlash to this, could take a decade till we see it.
So anything surprising a year later to you? I think we actually discussed this while I was in Israel last year. I think this conversation happened when the protests and riots had just begun. So a year ago, I'm sure we discussed, although frankly, I don't remember it. I barely remember what we discussed last week. But a year ago, I'm sure we discussed what, you know, where the future of Egypt was going. So now as you look back, you know, 12 months later, anything surprising here, or this is essentially what you expected?
Well, there are several things that are of great concern. I think the percentage by which they won is much different. If you remember, a year ago, they talked about, or less than that, but when after the downfall and then when they emerged from behind the scenes role to a much more open and public role and said they would run, but they wouldn't take more than 25% of the seats, then 30%
right.
of the seats.
Right.
When in fact now they have 70% of the seats.
Is it over? The elections are finished. All these series of elections.
All the elections are over. They are now moving on to the next phase. There is another house that will have an election, but it's relatively unimportant. These are the guys who appoint the 100-man committee. It should be 100 men because they probably won't appoint any women.
Right.
To draft the constitution, and the victory that they achieved, I think, stunned many people in Egypt. The fact is, though, that by and large, they do not have what's happening in Libya and in Syria and elsewhere, which is a complete breakdown of society and the groups being pitted against one another. But if I was a Copt in Egypt, I would be which is the Christian sect there, I would be very worried. I would not take any comfort in the current situation, as indeed we know that is the feeling amongst the Copts. So it's a country in transition. That their foreign reserves are down to, I think, 17 billion, which is exactly 4 months before they essentially declare bankruptcy. And the economic situation shows no sign of turning around.
What's the ethnic makeup in Libya, percentage-wise?
140 different tribes. It's an amalgam of everything from Berbers and Sunnis and Shiites and different tribal groups. So, but the you know, and now they're at each other's throats. They're killing each other, having open battles. And we see it, unfortunately, also in the opposition in Syria now at this point. And the generals who defect want to take over, and the guys who were there before say, "You're not coming in. I was already here before you." And they've even had clashes between them. And the Free Syrian Army is now in Douma, on the suburbs of Damascus. So they're growing all the time. But we're also seeing the influx of weapons. We're seeing, as I said, Hezbollah's role. I mean, it's just all these situations are so complicated, and nobody knows how these are going to end up.
You still there?
Yes.
Oh, thought the phone went out. You still have connections to Libya? Are there people there you speak to directly who keep you up to date on what's happening there?
I speak to people who are in the country. They're not Libyans. The Libyans I know are not right now talking. But I know people who are in there for both as media and as working on different projects.
Finally, Malcolm, Andrew Adler, who was the editor-in-chief for Georgia's Atlanta Jewish Times, has resigned after claiming that if Iran obtained nuclear weapons, Israel should have the Mossad assassinate President Obama. What was your reaction to his statement, and did you feel that it was necessary that he resign?
I don't think he had an option in the end because of the storm, his comments. But what he did is, as I understand, is to outline three options. And I don't think he meant it seriously, but, you know, you pay for the consequence of what you write or what you say.
Right.
And we see it now with this film, which is really an outrage, by the way, this jihad, third jihad film being skewered by the Muslims. And
This is the one that they were upset that Ray Kelly, the NYPD.
And Ray Kelly was part of it, and he should not have had to apologize.
Did he apologize?
Certainly not resign. Pardon me?
He did apologize?
Yes, he did. Yesterday he apologized for his participation in it. I think that's a shame that he's been put in that circumstance. The film, which has Giuliani in it, it has Professor Bernard Lewis, it has also Jim Woolsey, it has all sorts of people in there talking about a reality. And, you know, I don't know the context in which it was shown or what was shown, but the very fact that we've come to this point where a legitimate film and the people who made it now are skewered, there were many misrepresentations. The Times has done two or having more articles about it yet, which is, you know, simply outrageous. Before we close, I was
one
other thing this week, and that is that I was in Butner to visit, along with Richard Stone, to visit Jonathan Pollard.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to renew the appeal to people, again, after sitting with him and seeing both the serious physical conditions that he bears, but 27 years of incarceration, enough is enough. Whatever other things that people think, he has way served longer than anybody else. It is disproportionate. It is not legitimate. It's time for everyone to continue the efforts. Don't be dissuaded because you wrote and didn't get an answer. We just have to continue the efforts in every regard to gain his release.
Did he, excuse the way I asked this question, was he resentful at all, especially with you sitting there? And this is, again, not a condemnation of you, but obviously you represent quote-unquote official Jewish organizations to such a great extent. Was he resentful at all about how certain aspects of the Jewish establishment do not take up his cause?
No, he did not express resentment against anybody. Quite the opposite. His temperament seems to be one of very tolerant and forgiving. I mean, is he angry at people? Yes. Is he angry that people lied and that
Israeli government? I assume he certainly has issues
with. We have been active in this case for many, many years. We've written countless letters. We've made approaches to every president. I thought I had a deal with Clinton on it. We went to President Bush, who was not inclined to do anything, and we've raised it with President Obama, and we will continue to do so. But he is not a man who's lost in bitterness. He simply wants to go and rebuild his life and be talks about making a contribution and going to Israel to live there. He doesn't want to be involved in politics. He wants simply to be able to be with his wife and live his life out and have the proper medical treatment.
And now a question that I don't know how you can answer. How does he keep on going?
You know, we discussed this, Richard and I, and I want to thank Shlomo Zakheim for helping make it possible for us to be there, and Pesach Lerner, of course, who's been involved all the time on this. I tell you the truth, I have no clue. When you know the conditions there, you see a person there, he's 7 years, he was in solitary confinement. I can't imagine. I don't know how people don't go stir crazy. I don't know how the human capacity to adjust to the different circumstances. But, you know, having 27 years there and not seeing yet the real ray of hope, the light at the end of the tunnel, but continuing to work towards it and being committed to getting it, I think it's superhuman.
I'm asking this because in light of his medical condition, and obviously time goes by, does he look similar to the recent photos we've seen of him?
Yes, but he said he was a little bloated because he carries water, he has diabetes, he has other things that perhaps make him look more robust than his medical reality is. He does get some treatment, but it's not sufficient for what he needs. But putting even that aside, you have a matter of justice that enough is enough.
Right. And you've sat with some great minds in your career. Is he among them?
I didn't give him an IQ test, though.
No, but he does sometimes.
He's absolutely impressive.
His acumen and his intelligence usually makes a great impression on visitors.
Well, this I did see him. I have visited him before about 15 years ago. But he absolutely makes a very strong impression, a positive, very strong impression. His intellect, as you said, his understanding, and his currency with issues when he's not, you know, he has very limited access. It was very surprising how much he knew. And, you know, he has limited visitation rights, so we had to get permission and a special visit in order to come this week. So it's, you know, you go away feeling even greater obligation to continue to get the message out.
Well, you made good on your commitment. You said in January you'd see him, and you did.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great Shabbos. Yeah. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Weekly update here on a Friday.